The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. Michael Schumann, in his 1998 book, Going Local, said, "The only way communities can ensure their economic well-being is to start investing in community corporations. Prosperity follows when ownership, production, and consumption become intimately connected with place." He goes on, quote, "The only part of the production process that cannot move is land. Where consumers live, farmers grow food, producers operate factories, and workers clock in their time. Around these stationary islands emerged the network of people, art, music, crafts, religion, and politics that we call community," unquote. A great green convergence is happening. Those of us who work in local food systems feel its growing pulse now with each passing week. More and more people want to know where their food is coming from. Who grows it? Are workers getting a living wage? Are animals respected for their sacrifice? Is the land's fertility protected? They're asking how many calories of fossil fuel it takes to grow and transport a calorie of food. These concerns are ignited by questions about our highly centralized food system. Almost every week, there's another horror story about toxic, pathogenic, or genetic contamination somehow getting into our industrially produced food supply. Even our pets are not secure from this. Almost every week, there's another report of damage to an ancient ecosystem, stressed by global warming due to, in part, the way our food is grown and the long distance over which it is transported. The answers to these concerns converge on locally grown food. Over the past 12 years, I have helped to create our local food system, starting with the Southland Passyunk Farmers Market, the first of Philadelphia's recent outdoor markets. I started Farm to City in 2001. Since then, Farm to City's programs have catalyzed over $3.5 million in sales by local producers. Through our Farmers Market program, our Winter Harvest Buying Club, and assistance to CSA Farms. This work has been the most exciting I've ever done. I have met many dedicated people, the farmers, the customers, the community leaders, and my colleagues at a number of local organizations, the Fair Food Project out of the White Dog Community Enterprises, the Book and the Cook, the Reading Sherman Oak Market, the Sustainable Business Network, the Food Trust, and most recently the Common Market, a local food distribution center, and Green Village, Philadelphia, both in the planning stages. My bet is that most of the people here already shop at farmers markets, right? Yeah, all right, let's hear it. Thus, my words, thrown at the choir I am preaching at, urge the choir to proselytize. Grab your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your relatives. Grab them by their collars and take them to your farmer's market. Once their eyes are open to this wonderful connection in their lives, get them to spread the word. The farmers are marketing directly to their customers, much as did Lusa Maluf Landowski in Barbara Kingsolver's wonderful book, Prodigal Summer, in which this young widow transformed a patch of Appalachia and with it her survival on land and her local community by raising goats. Farmers are delivering a sacred icon, locally grown food, sacred because it will save us, our health, our communities, and ultimately our survival as a species on this planet. The farmers' market season is just about to begin, and I hope you all will go to one near you to get to know them and spend your food dollars on the farmer's products. And I have here two things that you can pick up out in the lobby, and it's a building our local food system, actions you can take, and it's a whole sheet of things, two sides, and then a little leaflet that shows where all our farmer's markets are in the Philadelphia area, and we're opening one in Havertown this year. Thank you very much. I now turn the podium over to Morris Williams, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Thank you.
Well, what a delight it is this evening to have the privilege of introducing one of America's most insightful writers, Barbara Kingsolver. In her new book, she writes that their highest goal was to get food from as close to their southeastern farm in Virginia so that they would know the people who had actually grown the food. In addition to great word pictures of a year spent growing and eating homegrown and local food, the book contains lovely narratives about vacations in New England and Italy. Part memoir, part investigative reporting. Animal, Vegetable, and Miracle also features informative sidebars written by Barbara Kingsolver's husband, Stephen Hopp, who is a biologist and college professor, and by her daughter, Camille, who writes from the perspective of a 19-year-old young lady, including such things as recipes and other items about how to prepare food on a fun and seasonal kind of basis. Unlike, I think, perhaps many people, I'm choosing to read a passage written by Camille because I think it really speaks to what we all are concerned about. She writes, "Living on the land that has grown my food gives me a sense of security I'm lucky to have. Feeling safe isn't so easy for people my age who face odious threats like global warming, overpopulation, and chemical warfare in our future. But even as the world runs out of fuel and the ice caps melt, I will know the real sources of my sustenance. My college education may or may not land me a good job down the road, but my farm education will serve me. The choices I make now about my food will influence the rest of my life. If a lot of us felt this way and started thinking carefully about our consumption habits just one meal at a time, we could affect the future of our planet. No matter how grave the predictions I hear about the future, for my peers and me, that's a fact that gives me hope." I think Camille's right. This is also a book about a journey of one family and an introduction to the rest of us about ways that we can engage in the fight against global warming and the fight against our dependence on foreign oil. It gives me great pleasure, and I hope you'll join me in giving a warm Philadelphia welcome to Barbara Kingsolver, welcoming her to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
I didn't do anything yet. Thank you so much. I am delighted to be here in the city of brotherly farmers markets. I am just tickled to learn as much as I've learned in the last 8 hours or so that I've been in your city about the green and burgeoning community movements you have here. If tonight has been your first contribution to Farm to City, I thank you for that, and I hope you'll become more involved in the future. If it's not the first time you've done something for Farm to City, I thank you for that too. I am going to read to you tonight from something. This brand new book that came out yesterday. My first full-length narrative nonfiction. That was really fun to write, especially because it was co-authored, as you probably already heard, with my husband, Stephen Hopp, and my daughter, Camille. The the story I wrote, they said, Mom, you have to make it interesting. That was my job. Make it a page turner. So I wrote a story of a year in my family's life, and they contributed little essays and factual sidebars along the way. We had a really good time. Oh, and as you also may have noticed, this isn't just advertising here. We have for you tonight an audio-visual presentation. This is the first time ever that we've done this. Last night we were in the National Cathedral, and that was its own show. So are you, of course. But this should be interesting. So here we go. Animal, vegetable, miracle. A year of food life. And I'm going to begin with kind of a condensation of excerpts from the first chapter. A fair definition of American food is that it typically travels farther than Americans do. Our average food item covers 1,500 miles to reach us. Because of industrial farming and food transport, we're now putting almost as much gasoline into our diets as into our cars. When my family moved from Arizona to a farming community in southern Appalachia, we were called there for many reasons, including work and extended family. But one of our reasons was food. As the U.S. population made a mad dash for the Sun Belt, one carload of us jumped ship and headed for the promised land, where water falls from the sky and green stuff grows all around, to begin the adventure of realigning our lives with our food chain. Naturally, our first stop was to buy junk food and fossil fuel. In a cinder block convenience mart on the outskirts of Tucson on moving day, we foraged the aisles for road food. Our family's natural foods teenager scooped up a pile of energy bars big enough to pass as a retirement plan for a hamster. Our family's congenitally frugal mother shelled out $2 for a fancy green bottle of about a nickel's worth of iced tea. As long as we were going crazy here, we threw in some 99-cent bottles of what comes for free out of drinking fountains in Perrier, France. In our present location, 99 cents was a bargain. Arizona was suffering the worst drought in its history. 1 inch of rainfall in the last 7 months. Even a desert can die of thirst. As we gathered our loot on the counter, the sky suddenly darkened. After 200 consecutive cloudless days, you forget what it looks like when a cloud crosses the sun. We all blinked. The cashier frowned toward the plate glass window. "Dang," she said, "if it isn't going to rain." "I hope so," Stephen said. She turned her scowl from the window to Stephen. This bleach blonde guardian of gas pumps and snack food was not amused. "It better not," is all I can say. "But we need it," I pointed out. I am not one to argue with cashiers, but this was my very last minute as a Tucsonan. I hated to jinx it with bad precipitation karma. I know that's what they're saying, but I don't care," she avowed. "Tomorrow's my first day off in 2 weeks, and I want to wash my car." For 300 miles we drove that day through desperately parched Sonoran badlands, chewing our salty cashews with a peculiar guilt. We had all shared this wish, in some way or another, that it wouldn't rain on our day off. Thunderheads dissolved ahead of us. In our desert, we would not see rain again. Now we are settled on a farm in southwestern Virginia, in a county where cashiers almost always speak up for rain during a drought. A disastrously dry summer would mean neighbors losing their farms. It would affect school enrollments and local businesses. It's not a trivial difference, praying for or against rainfall during a drought. Historically speaking, humans tend to get what we wish for. What are the just deserts for a species too selfish or preoccupied to hope for rain when the land outside is dying? Should we be buried in our own clean cars to make room for wiser creatures? We'd surely do better if we only knew any better. Most people of my grandparents' generation had nearly an instinctive knowledge of agricultural basics. What vegetables grow well in one's immediate region, when they are in season, and how to live well on just those, with little else thrown into the mix beyond a bag of flour, a pinch of salt, and a handful of coffee. This knowledge is gone. We also have largely convinced ourselves it wasn't too important. The baby boom psyche embraces a powerful presumption that education is a key to moving away from dirt and manual labor, two undeniable ingredients of farming. It's good enough for us that somebody, somewhere, knows food production well enough to serve the rest of us with all we need to eat. If that is true, why isn't it good enough for someone else to know multiplication tables and the Bill of Rights? Isn't ignorance about our food causing problems as diverse and serious as our overdependence on petroleum and epidemic obesity? The multiple maladies caused by bad eating are taking a dire toll on our health, most tragically for our kids, who are predicted to be this country's first generation to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. That alone is a stunning enough fact to give us pause. So is a government policy that advises us to eat more fruits and vegetables, while doling out subsidies not to fruit and vegetable farmers, but to commodity crops destined to become high fructose corn syrup and feedlot grain for cheap burgers. Many of us do understand that our food choices are politically charged, affecting arenas from rural culture to international oil cartels and global warming. Plenty of consumers are trying to get off the petroleum-driven industrial food wagon. This book is about how our family joined that small revolution, trying to integrate food choices with our family values, which include both love your neighbor and try not to wreck every blooming thing on your planet while you're here. Families in many other countries have food pledges hanging over their kitchens, subtle rules about going to extra trouble, cutting the pasta by hand, rolling the sushi, making with care instead of buying on the cheap, though they also may be busy with jobs and modern life. People the world over still take time to follow foodways that bring their families happiness and health. My family happens to live in a country where the main foodway has a yellow line painted down the middle. If we needed new rules, we'd have to make our own, going on faith that it might bring us something worthwhile. This is the story of a year in which we made every attempt to feed ourselves animals, vegetables, and even minerals whose provenance we really knew. Our highest shopping goal was to get our food from so close to home we'd know the person who grew it. Often, that turned out to be us, as we learned to produce more of what we needed, starting with dirt, seeds, and enough knowledge to muddle through. Or starting with baby animals, and enough knowledge to refrain from naming them. See what I mean? You name these and you're sunk by Thanksgiving. Now, we're much less sentimental about these, right? We cut their heads off with impunity. Who cares, right? And these, we cut their heads off, even though they do have names. This is broccoli romanesco. We had been growing some of our own food for many years. In fact, as long as we'd been a family, that's Camille and Lily. But we decided, of course, when we moved to our farmhouse in Virginia, we were going to do this in a much more deliberate way. We spent that first summer somewhat preoccupied with remodeling a 100-year-old farmhouse, which had 100-year-old plumbing and an author with power tools, a terrifying concept. But we found time to plant a modest garden, and we also began getting to know our own local farmers and what they brought to the market. We were still at this point buying most of our food from the grocery store, but even there, we began paying closer attention, looking at the sources of everything, finding local sources for our flour, honey, dairy. We were pleased to find a lot of these things within 100 or so miles of where we lived. And we knew that from these basic staples, we would have to make a lot of our own things. We worked on our food skills. This is my mother-in-law. We're making mozzarella here. So we worked on our food skills so we wouldn't have to import as much anything. That was our goal, at any rate. We did decide that a handful of things we would still get from far away, including coffee and spices, because we could get these things through fair trade, and so knowing that we would be able to compensate the farmers fairly. And also because coffee and these handful of things are dry goods, fairly easy to transport relative to refrigerated produce. And they represent a minuscule portion, really, of our diet. Most of what we eat are vegetables, fruits, eggs, and meats, and dairy. And we made up our minds that all of these things we were going to get from our own county. No exceptions. No California produce. This was it for 1 year. So with our ground rules in place, we were ready to start, all set to begin. But January 1st, when it came, didn't look like such a great time to start. February didn't look so good either. And even March, where we live, doesn't have a lot to offer in the way of green things growing out of the ground. We began to realize that if we were going to do this for a full year, we were going to have to get through some lean time sooner or later. That dog might look pretty fat, you know. When March started really seriously blooming on our farm, we began to ask ourselves, this question was leaning on us, what are we waiting for? When do we start? We decided we were waiting for asparagus. That's the very first vegetable to emerge in our latitude, and yours too, most parts of the U.S. And so we did. We began our year of local eating on the day that asparagus emerged from our own weedy garden here. And off we went. Lucky for us, our farmer's market also opened that week. And to tell you the truth, the offerings at the farmer's market in April were still pretty lean, but April seemed like a time to start because it's a really hopeful month. So much color, a lot of new green things emerging from the ground. And so we started out with a lot of salads, spinach frittatas. We hunted morels in the woods behind our house. That first week we made a morel and asparagus pizza. And we discovered, wow, this is not so bad. It was also the time we began establishing a grocery store in our backyard. We would get some things from the farmer's market, but really wanted to grow a lot of our vegetables ourselves. And this requires a certain amount of, a lot of thinking ahead, because you start it all in the spring pretty much. So how many heads of cabbage does a family eat in a year? We had no idea. How much celery root? We made our best guesses, and we set out a garden in the largest plot of tilled ground we had ever gone for. It's about 3,500 square feet, which isn't huge, but it's big. It was a lot of work, and evenings, every evening and weekend went into this endeavor. And we also intended to manufacture our own local eggs. That was my younger daughter Lily's project, she decided, which of course brings up the question, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And at our house, the answer was clearly the chicken. Which brings us to chapter 6, which is called The Birds and the Bees. Our postmistress sounded unfazed on the morning she called to say, "You better come get this package. It's making a pretty good racket." We rushed down to the P.O., for the package with my daughter's name on it, a little cardboard mailing crate with dime-sized holes on all sides and 28 voices inside, the noise density quotient of one kindergarten packed into one shoebox. Lily picked it up and started crooning like a new mother. This date had been circled on her calendar for months. April 23rd, my baby's due. It's hard to overstate her fondness for chickens. Other 8-year-old girls have Barbie posters on their bedroom walls. Mine had a calendar titled The Fairest Fowl. One of the earliest lessons in poultry husbandry I had to teach Lily was why we don't kiss chickens on the mouth. Her plan now was to start her own egg business, not just to help feed the family, but to earn money. As the business began to take shape in her mind in recent weeks, Lily had even determined she was going to save enough money to buy a horse. She had been asking me questions lately about the price of horse flesh. "Just a regular mare or a gelding," she said, to be perfectly clear. When it comes to mares and geldings, she knows the score. I had heard her explaining this to some of her friends in the back seat of the car one day as I was driving. "A stallion is a boy that's really fierce and bossy," she told her rapt little friends. "But they can give them an operation that makes them gentle and nice and helpful. You know, like our daddies." Okay, then. She knew what she was looking for. We knew the chicks were coming this morning, so I had allowed her to stay home from school to wait for the call. Once she'd brought her chicks home and started their new life under her care, Lily was ready to get back to third grade. When we signed her in at the principal's office, the secretary needed a reason for tardiness. Lily threw back her shoulders and announced, "I had to start my own chicken business this morning." The secretary said without blinking, "Oh, okay, farming," and entered the code for excused agriculture. Just another day at our elementary school. I already had my own project underway. 15 baby turkeys, which had arrived by mail the previous week. That one shoebox of fluff, plus grain, grass, and thyme, would add up to some 300 pounds of our year's food supply. We had decided that if we meant to eat anything, meat included, we'd be more responsible tenants of our food chain if we could participate in the steps that bring it to the table. You can leave the killing to others and pretend it never happened, or you can look it in the eye. We'd settled on a strategy of giving our food a good life until it was good on the table. Our turkeys would enjoy freedom, sunshine, and the company of their kind. And some of these birds would survive Thanksgiving if all went according to plan. Our goal was to establish a breeding flock. These were some very special turkeys. Of the 400 million turkeys Americans consume each year, more than 99% of them are one single breed, the broad-breasted white, a quick-fattening monster bred specifically for industrial-scale turkey farming. These are the big lugs so famously dumb they can drown by looking up at the rain. If one of these escapes slaughter, it probably won't live to be a year old. They get so heavy their legs collapse. They are incapable of flight, foraging, or mating. That's right, reproduction. Genes that make turkeys behave like animals are of no use to a creature packed wing to wing with thousands of others and might cause it to get cranky or suicidal. So those genes have been bred out of the pool. Docile lethargy works better and helps them pack on the pounds. This trend holds for all animals bred for confinement. In the case of the breast-heavy, broad-breasted whites, this scheme has left them with a combination of deformity and idiocy that renders them unable to have turkey sex. Poor turkeys. So, how do we get more of them? Well, you might ask. The sperm must be artificially extracted from live male turkeys by a person, a professional turkey sperm wrangler, if you will, and artificially introduced to the hens, and that is all I'm going to say about that. Except that if you think they send them off to the men's room with a little paper cup and Playhen magazines, that's not how it goes. I will add this. If you are the sort of parent who threatens your teenagers with a future of unsavory jobs when they ditch school, here's one more career you might want to add to the list. When our family considered raising turkeys, we knew we were not going to go there. I was intrigued by what I knew of heritage breeds, especially after Slow Food USA launched its campaign to reacquaint American palates with the flavors of heritage turkeys. All the special qualities of heirloom vegetables are found in heirloom breeds of domestic animals, too. Hundreds of varieties of turkeys, chickens, sheep, pigs, and cattle that were well known to farmers a century ago, but whose numbers have declined nearly to extinction. In addition to special flavors, these breeds retain more of their wild ancestors' genetic diversity, disease resistance, and sense about foraging in the pasture rather than enduring life in a windowless metal house. Heritage animal listings have the same literary allure as heirloom seed catalogs. Your Tennessee fainting goats, your Florida cracker cattle, the American mammoth jackass, and eight kinds of heritage turkeys, birds whose endearing traits include the capacity to do their own breeding all by themselves. We picked the Bourbon Red. Fewer than 2,000 of these birds still exist in breeding flocks. Slow Food has employed the paradox of saving rare breeds by getting more people to eat them. And that's exactly what happened in the 2003 Arc of Taste project. So many people signed up in the spring for heirloom Thanksgiving turkeys instead of the standard butterball, an unprecedented number of U.S. farmers were called on to raise them. The demand has continued since then. So we jumped on that wagon, hoping to have our rare birds and eat them too. And there he is, one of our handsome Bourbon Reds. Before, after, a small medical procedure. And here's the family album. Lily's chickens, the day they arrived. Oh. That's one of my turkeys, the day of its arrival. They grow up so fast. Out on pasture at about 1 week of age, they're very good at catching bugs. Very quickly reaching the adolescent, awkward, bad feather day stage. We put them on bug patrol in the garden. And before you know it, they're starting to look like food. May and June are, that's my husband. This is one of the only pictures on Earth of my husband because he's the photographer. He takes all the pictures. May and June are work months of almost endless work for the farmer and gardener, but we were excited because late May and early June also brought us an ever-widening menu of choices from which to make our meals. We moved from kale soups and spinach frittatas into the first fruits of the year, which are strawberries, in our part of the world, and yours too. In June, you can start to steal new potatoes from the mother plants. You can harvest prize-winning broccoli. And the last of the peas come in, and soon the very earliest beans. Blueberries start to ripen, leading to the very exciting prospect of tree fruits. The season for tree fruits is short, and so for local eating, fresh fruit is one of the things you do really wait for with excitement. There we are. There's the other picture of my husband. We found ourselves, before we knew it, with lots of things to eat and a surplus of practically everything that we grow, including chickens, zucchini, of course, melons, beautiful eggplants, and tomatoes. Lots of tomatoes. And this brings us to chapter 13, which is called Life in a Red State. However jaded I may become, winter knocks down the hollow stem of my worldliness, and I start each summer again with the expectation simple as a child's. The first tomato of the season brings me to my knees. Its vital stats are recorded in my journal with the care of a birth announcement. It's an early girl, 4 ounces, June 16th. Blessed event, we've waited so long. Over the next weeks, I note the number, size, and quality of the different tomato varieties as they begin to come in. Green zebras, jaune flammés, Russian blacks. This year, though, by early August, I'd shifted from recording numbers to pounds. We brought in each day's harvest in plastic grocery sacks we heaved onto a butcher's scale in the kitchen, jotting down the number on a notepad before moving on to processing. We had officially moved beyond hobby scale as we sought to answer the question that was largely the point of this exercise. What does it take, literally, to keep a family fed? My one area of confidence was tomatoes. We couldn't have too many. In July, all seemed to be going according to plan when we hauled in just over 50 pounds. In August, the figure jumped to 302 pounds. Tomatoes covered the countertops end to end, from the front edge to the backsplash. The cutting board stayed full. The knives kept slicing. We put up almost every kind of vegetable in late summer, but the tomatoes, with their sunny flavor and short shelf life, demand the most attention. We wish for them in leisure and repent in haste. Putting up roasting, canning, and drying. Putting up summer produce is a useful option for anyone who can buy it from local markets. And it's a kindness to the farmers who will have to support their families in December on whatever they sell in August. They can't put their unsold tomatoes in the bank. But ours would be in the freezer and the pantry, sauced, dried, and canned. Having gone nowhere in the interim, they would still be local in February. In some supermarket chains in Virginia and Tennessee, shoppers can find organic vegetables in packages labeled Appalachian Harvest. The letters of the brand name arch over a sunny farm scene and the assurance, healthy food, healthy farms, close to home. Labels can lie, I am perfectly aware, but the Appalachian Harvest vegetables really do come from healthy farms. I happen to know, because they're close to my home. Brand recognition in supermarkets is an exciting development for farmers there in a region that struggles with chronic environmental problems and a steady drain of young people from the farming economy. Getting some of Appalachia's harvest into those packages has not been simple, though. The farmers need special training, organic certification, reliable markets, and a packaging plant. The resourceful group converted an old tobacco barn into its packing house, where farmers bring vegetables by the truckload. After planting, weeding, and keeping the crop pest-free all season without chemicals, the final step of picking often begins before dawn. Each box is labeled as it arrives, so the grower's identity will follow the vegetables through washing and grading all the way to their point of wholesale purchase. Farmers are paid after the supermarket issues its check. The project gains a few more committed growers each year, with neighbors watching, eager to see whether this enormous commitment to new methods will be salvation or disaster. On a midsummer day in the packing house, the tomatoes bounce down a conveyor belt, several bushels per minute, as workers check for flaws and ripeness, packaging and pressing on the certified organic sticker. I do know some people who can hardly stand to hear that word because of how organic is personified for them. Dreadlocked, Birkenstocked, standing at the checkout with the Intestinal Joy brand wheatgrass juice. Well, for the record, this is what Appalachian Harvest organics look like at the source. Red Wing work boots, barbershop haircuts, Levi's with a little mud on the cuffs, men and women who probably go to church on Sunday but keep their religion to themselves as they bring a day's work to this packing house inside a former tobacco barn. If sanctimony is an additive in their product, it gets added elsewhere. I grew up among farmers. In my school system in Kentucky, we were all born to our rank as inescapably as Hindus, the castes being only two, farm and town. Though my father worked in town, we did not live there, and so by the numinous but unyielding rules of high school, I was farmer. It might seem astonishing that a rural-urban distinction like this could be made in a county that boasted exactly two stoplights and one hardware store. After I went away to school, I remained in more or less constant marvel over the fact that my so-called small liberal arts college, with an enrollment of about 2,000, was 25% larger than my hometown. And yet, even in a community as rural as that, we still had our self-identified bourgeoisie categorically distinguished from our rustics. Urban, of course, is relative. But the bottom line is, it matters. Everywhere in our country, the antipathy in our culture between the urban and non-urban is so durable, it has its own vocabulary. A, city slicker, tenderfoot. B, hick, redneck, hayseed, bumpkin, rube, yokel, clodhopper, hillbilly, dogpatch, Daisy May, farmer's daughter, something out of Deliverance. Maybe you see where I'm going with this. The list is lopsided. I don't think there's much doubt on either side as to which class is winning the culture wars. In my own life, I've had ample opportunity to reinvent myself as a city person, to pass, as it were. But I've remained tacitly rural-identified in my psyche, even while living in some of the world's major cities. It's probably this dual citizenship that has sensitized me to my nation's urban-rural antipathy and how it affects people in both camps. Rural concerns are less covered by the mainstream media and often considered intrinsically comic. The policy of our nation is made in cities, controlled largely by urban voters who aren't well informed about the changes on the face of our land and the men and women who work it. Those changes can be mapped on worry lines. As the years have gone by, as farms have gone out of business, America has given an ever smaller cut of each food dollar to its farmers, now less than 19 cents for each dollar. The psychic divide between rural and urban people is surely a part of the problem. Wendell Berry writes, "Eaters must understand that eating takes place inescapably in the world, that it is inescapably an agricultural act, and that how we eat determines to a considerable extent how the world is used." Eaters must, he claims, but it sure looks like most eaters don't. The urban U.S. middle class appears more specifically concerned about exploited Asian factory workers. Symptomatic of this rural-urban identity crisis is our eager embrace of a recently imposed divide, the red states and the blue states. That color map comes to us with the suggestion that both coasts are populated by educated civil libertarians, while the vast middle and south are crisscrossed with the studded tracks of ATVs leaving a trail of flying beer cans and rebel yells. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but I certainly sense that when urban friends ask how I can stand living so far from everything. Some refer to the whole chunk of our continent lying between the Cascades and the Hudson River as the interior. It's hard for me to see the usefulness of lumping Minneapolis, Atlanta, Yellowstone Park, and so forth into a single category that does not include New York and California. Going to the interior sounds like it might require machetes. In fact, the politics of rural regions are no more predictable than those in cities. My earliest understanding of radical class-conscious politics came from miners' strikes in one of the most rural parts of my state and our nation. Conservative is a reasonable position for a farmer who can lose home and livelihood all in one year by taking a risk on a new crop. But that's conservative, as in eager to conserve what we have, and unrelated to how the term is currently applied in party politics. The only useful generalization I'd hazard about rural politics is that they tend to break on the line of insider versus outsider. When my country neighbors sit down with a new social group, the first question they ask one another is not, "What do you do?" but rather, "Who are your people?" The country tradition of mistrusting outsiders is not hard to understand. For much of U.S. history, rural regions have been treated essentially as colonial property of the cities. The carpetbaggers were not the first or the last opportunists to capitalize on an extractive economy. When urban companies come to the country with a big plan, whether their game is coal, timber, or industrial agriculture, the plan is to take out the good stuff, ship it to the population centers, make a fortune, and leave behind a mess. Our nation, in almost every region, is divided in a near-dead heat between two political parties. If every state were visually represented with the exact blend of red and blue it earned in recent elections, we'd have ourselves a big purple country. Our uneasy relationship between heartland and coasts, farm and factory, country and town, is certainly real, but it is more subtle than most analysts make it out to be. It's about loyalties, perceived communities, and the things each side understands to be important because of the ground, literally, upon which we stand. Sorry. In high summer, about the time I was seeing red in my kitchen, the same thing happened to some of our county's tomato farmers. They had learned organic methods, put away the chemicals, and done everything right to grow a product consumers claimed to want. They'd waited the 3 years for certification. They'd watered, weeded, and picked, producing the perfect organic tomatoes ordered by grocery chains. And then, suddenly, when the farmers were finally beginning to bring these tomatoes in by the truckload and hoping for a decent payout, grocery buyers backtracked. "Not this week," one store offered without warning, and then another. "Not the next week either. A tomato is not a thing that can be put on hold." Mountains of ripe fruits piled up behind the packing house and turned to orange sludge, swarming with clouds of fruit flies. These tomatoes were perfect, and buyers were hungry. Agreements had been made, but pallets of organic tomatoes from California had begun coming in just a few dollars cheaper. It's hard to believe, given the amount of truck fuel involved, but transportation is tax-deductible for the corporations, so we taxpayers paid for that shipping. The California growers only needed a cheap army of pickers and customers who would reliably opt for the lower price. As simply as that, a year of planning and family labor turned to red mush. Our growers had been warned that this could happen. Supermarkets will almost never sign a binding contract. So the farmers took a risk and took a loss. Some of them will try again next year. Courage, practicality, and making the best of a bad situation are much of what farming is about. Before the tomatoes all rotted away, Appalachian Harvest found a way to donate the enormous excess of unpurchased tomatoes to needy families through our food bank. One of the farmers told me, "We were glad we could give it away, but a lot of us are barely making ends meet ourselves. It seems like it's always the people that have the least who end up giving the most. Why is that?" In Charlottesville, Roanoke, and Knoxville, supermarket shoppers had no idea what betrayal might be wrapped up in those cellophane two-packs of California tomatoes. Maybe they noticed the other tomatoes were missing this week, with the Healthy Farms Close to Home label. Or maybe they just saw organic tomatoes, picked them up, and dropped them into their carts on top of the cereal boxes and paper towels. Eaters must understand how we eat determines how the world is used. They will or they won't, and the happy grocery store music plays on. These are some of my friends who are farmers, whose families depend on the choices that we make as consumers. That's Tom, Amy, Amadeo. Anthony. Christy and one of her picturesque cows. At summer's end, whatever the farmers have earned is what they have to carry them through the winter. Likewise, or in a similar way, we found ourselves at the end of summer with what we hoped would carry us through the winter, because in the fall our farmers market closed. Things looked pretty good for us. Our kitchen was a really happy place. Lily became a hand model. The chickens owned the place. Lily's business opened in the fall. Lily's Lovely Layers. Some of our heritage turkeys left their legacy on our table. And we found ourselves moving into a quieter, more interior season. Our pantry was reassuring to us. We hoped that what we had put by would be enough. And we found in January, we were still eating wonderfully, well enough anyway. And so it seemed to us this crazy, impossibly simple thing was really going to happen. We were going to do this. Chapter 18, Hungry Month. In late February, I was ready to believe we and all our animals had come through the lean times unscathed. And then one of our turkey hens took to standing around looking droopy. She let her wings drop to the ground instead of folding them on her back in normal turkey fashion. Her shoulders hunched and her head jutted forward, giving her a Nixon-esque air. Minus the eyebrows and crafty agenda, this girl just looked dazed. Oh no, I thought, here we go. Poultry husbandry is notoriously challenging. The list of afflictions that can strike down a turkey would excite any hypochondriac. Blackhead roundworm, crop bind, coccidiosis, paratyphoid, and much, much more. In one of my poultry handbooks, the turkey chapter is subtitled, A Dickens to Raise. But I'd taken all the doomsaying with a grain of salt. All turkey info sources refer to the standard factory farm turkey. My Bourbon Reds were not bred for sluggardly indoor fattening, but for scrappy survival in the great outdoors. They retain a genetic constitution for foraging, mating, and I hoped, resisting germs. Still, my goal of keeping these birds alive through the winter into their second year for breeding was statistically audacious. The great majority of modern turkeys can expect an earthly duration of only 4 months before meeting their processor. Fewer than 0.5% of domestic turkeys live past their first Thanksgiving. At 9 months, my flock had now entered that elite age bracket, the oldest living turkeys in America. And I had no clue what my poor droopy hen might have. Assuming she'd be contagious, I ushered her out of the turkey pen into an isolation room in our barn. Miss Droop perked right up, shaking her fluffed feathers neatly back into place and looking around brightly. I hardly trusted this miracle recovery, but an hour later, when I came back to check on her, she was still perky. I led her back to the pen, where she walked into the midst of her brethren, heaved a great turkey sigh, and drooped back down again. Okay, I wasn't imagining it. I shepherded her back down to the barn and once again watched in astonishment as she lifted her head and began to walk around cheerfully. I stared at her and asked, "Are you goldbricking?" It was a sunny Saturday, our first little sneak preview of spring. My husband was in the orchard working on the fence. I decided my poultry patient could use a mental health day. I let her out of the barn and we walked toward the orchard. Stephen saw us coming down the lane together and laughed. Turkey herders are not a respected class of people. She needs some fresh pasture, I said defensively. She had some kind of droopy sickness. She looks fine, he said, and went back to the fence that's meant to discourage deer from eating our young pear orchard. For a few minutes, I watched Ms. Turkey happily foraging among the trees, looking as healthy as the day she was born. I inspected the pear trees. Suddenly, Stephen yelled, "Hey, knock it off!" I looked up to see he wasn't talking to me. My charge had wandered over to him, approaching from behind and reaching up with her beak to give his jacket a good tug. Issuing a turkey mandative, I would translate as, "Hey, look at me!" He nudged her away, but she persisted. After several more tugs, he turned to face her directly, planted his feet, and made a very manly sort of huff. On that cue, she coyly turned her tail toward him, jutted her neck, and dropped her wings to the ground. Oh, my goodness. It wasn't, "Hey, look at me." It was, "Hey, sailor, new in town?" She had lovesickness. Stephen shot me a look I will not translate here. "Stop that," I yelled. "He is so not your type." I ran to interrupt her progress in case she meant to move their relationship to the next level. Poor thing, how would she know? She was raised by humans with no chance to imprint on adult turkeys or observe proper turkey relations. As far as she knew, I was her mother. It's only logical that the person I married would strike her as a good catch. I ushered her hastily back to the turkey pen, putting the kibosh on her plot to win away my husband. But now what? We'd kept 6 females for breeding purposes. Were they all about to come into season? Who needed to be separated from whom? Would every hen need her own nest? I had assumed I'd crossed these bridges when I came to them. Now, like parents of turkey teens everywhere, I was caught by surprise. They're too young for this. It's only February. I went in to check our farm library for anything I could find about turkey mating behavior and spent way too much of a beautiful day on the floor with books stacked all around me. Our poultry husbandry manuals contained a total of nothing about turkey sex. You'd think some turkey fundamentalists had been in here burning books. The problem, of course, was that I was looking for a category of information nobody has needed for decades. The whole birds and bees business has been bred out of turkeys. Artificial insemination and incubators stand in for parenting. Farmers acquire hatchlings, fatten them quickly, and off with their heads. Poultry handbooks don't go into mating behavior because turkey mating has gone the way of rubberized foundation garments and the drive-in movie. To restore some old-fashioned sex to our farm, I was going to have to scour my sources for some decent sex ed. The internet was no help. A search for turkey mating scored 670,000 hits, mostly along the lines of this lively dispatch from the Missouri Department of Conservation. "More excitement this week. Hunters statewide will find gobblers more responsive to calls. The key to success is sounding like a lovesick turkey hen." I had a lovesick turkey hen. I tried limiting my search to domestic turkeys. I still got thousands of hits, but not one shred of fact about turkey hokey pokey. I did learn the name turkey for this solely North American bird comes from a 400-year-old geographic mistake made by the English. I learned that the wrinkled red and blue flesh on a turkey's head is called his caruncle. I learned that the French know this bird as dindon sauvage. That is when I fled from the electronic library, returning to my limited but reassuring paper one, where I was safe from the random onslaught of savage ding-dongs. Finally, I hit pay dirt. My spouse has a weakness for antique natural history books, and among them I found a thick tome by E.S.E. Hafez called The Behavior of Domestic Animals. It was published mid-20th century, before animal science had taken the tomfoolery out of the toms. What caught my eye as I flipped through the book was a photo with this caption, "Female turkey giving the sexual crouch to man." The text confirmed that females imprinted to humans would grow up to have the hots for humans. But given the chance, it said, they might be open-minded about male turkeys as well. Oh, good. Reading on, I learned this droopy posturing is the first sign of sexual receptiveness in girl turkeys. Soon we could expect to see a more extended courtship that would include stomping, boy, deeper crouch, girl, then mounting and treading around as the male manipulated the female's erogenous wing zones, followed by the copulatory sequence. Egg laying would begin in about 2 weeks. Eggs and nest were all theoretical at this point. If I wanted to raise turkeys the natural way, I was signing up for a strong possibility of failure, not to mention a deep involvement in the sexual antics of a domestic bird. My interests weren't prurient. As a biologist and a PTA member, I have a healthy respect for motherhood. The longer I think about a food industry organized around an animal that can't reproduce itself without assistance, the more I mistrust it. Poultry, a significant part of the modern diet, seems symbolic of the whole dirty deal. Maintaining a naturally breeding flock is a rebellion against the wholly artificial nature of how foods are produced. I was the rebel. That was my cause. I had more than sentimental reasons for wanting to see my turkey hens brood and hatch their own babies. I plowed on through my antique reference for more details, which got better and better. "Male turkeys," I read, and this is a quote, I swear, "can be forced to broodiness by first being made drowsy, e.g. by an ample dose of brandy, and then being put on a nest with eggs. After recovery from the hangover, broodiness is established. This method was used extensively by farmers in Europe before incubators were available." I don't think of myself as the type to ply turkey menfolk with brandy and hoodwink them into fatherhood, but a girl needs to know her options. Okay, one more scene, very short. Are you ready for this? A week later, Lolita was getting no action. Our two toms had been fanning their tails in urgent mating display since last summer, but they always directed their show-off efforts toward me or any sexy thing I might leave sitting around, such as a watering can. She plopped herself down where they'd have to trip over her, but they only had eyes for some shiny little item. She sulked, and I didn't blame her. Who hasn't been there? Determined to set a more romantic scene, I escorted Lolita and one of the toms into a small private room inside the barn and removed any watering cans from his line of sight. She practically had to connect the dots for him, but he finally started to get the picture. She crouched, he approached, and finally stopped quivering his tail feathers to impress her. After all these months, it took him a couple of beats to shift gears from get the babe, to, oh, yes. Inch by inch, he walked up onto her back, then turned around in circles, slowly, like the minute hand of a clock, striving for the correct orientation. I was ready to hear the case for artificial insemination, but it looked now like he was giving it a go. The final important event after all this awkward foreplay is what bird scientists call the cloacal kiss. A male bird doesn't have anything you would call a member or whatever you call it at your house. He just has an orifice or a cloaca, more or less the same equipment as the female, except that semen is ejected from his and eggs come out of hers later on. Those eggs will be fertile only if the two orifices have previously made the prescribed kind of well-timed contact. I watched, I don't mind saying. Come on, wouldn't you? Possibly you would not have stooped quite as low as I did for the better view, but geez, we don't get cable out here. And truly, this was an extraordinary event, something that's nearly gone from our living world. For 99% of domestic turkeys, life begins in the syringe and remains sexless to the end. Few people have witnessed what I was about to see. Cloacal kiss is exactly the right name for it. The male really has to extend that orifice, like puckering up for a big smooch. Try to picture this, though. He's standing on her back, tromping steadily and clutching his lady so as not to fall off. The full complement of her long tail feather fan lies between his equipment and hers. The pucker has to be heroic to get around all that. Robert Browning said it perfectly. Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp. Or what's a heaven for? Paradise arrives when a fellow has kneaded his lady's erogenous wing zones for a long, long time with his feet until she finally decides her suitor has worked himself up to the necessary fervor. Without warning, quick as an eye blink, she flips up her tail feathers and reaches upward to meet him. Oh my gosh, I gasped to see it. It was an air kiss. They really did miss. Mwah! Like a pair of divas on stage who don't want to muss their lipstick. Not Britney and Madonna. She wandered off, slightly dazed, to a corner of the dark little room. He stared after her, his feathers all slack for once in his life, divining that this was not the time to put on a show. He knit his caruncled brow and surely would have quoted Shakespeare if he'd had it in him. Trip no further, pretty sweeting. Journeys end in lovers meeting. She pecked at some grain on the floor. Probably she'd been hoping for better room service. I left them there to love again on the morrow, or maybe 15 minutes. After all, they were kids. For the first time on any stage, here comes the audience. I'm not too interested. Maybe somewhat interested. We do amuse ourselves. Not what you expected to see when you came out tonight, did you? Can we have the house lights up? The reading was a little longer than I expected. You were patient. Thank you. We still, I think, have time for a few questions if you'd like to do that. Yes. Yeah, you in black. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I would love to. This is what they gave me. Okay, thank you. Yes, that question was, would I try Philadelphia tap water, which is not shipped in? Yeah, maybe they filled this up in the bathroom. Is that what you did? Thank you so much. You know, it's a really interesting thing when people bring up, oh, it costs a little more to buy local produce or to buy organic. The majority of U.S. citizens buy bottled water, and the standards, the government standards that regulate the quality of our tap water are higher than those for bottled water. So what are we thinking? Yes. Sure, I would. The question is, would I talk about the journey that I've made from fiction into nonfiction? That journey seems to take me in circles because I about half my books are fiction. This is number 12, believe it or not. I'm shocked myself. And the others, the other books of mine that are not novels are poetry, essays, an oral history, and now a narrative nonfiction. For me, the beginning is a theme, some really important question I'm wrestling with that I want to confine into a shape that I can deliver to you. And a way that I can write my way to an answer to this question. And so after I begin with theme, I find the right vehicle to transport it. Sometimes that might be a poem or a short story. Sometimes it's a novel. Sometimes it's nonfiction. In this case, it was clearly a narrative nonfiction. So I'm always going to take... I don't consider it a journey to go back and forth. I really consider each new theme is its own journey, and I find how to craft it. It was very interesting, however, to me to find that in writing this story, all of the elements were exactly the same as what's needed for a novel. It needed to be scenic. It needed to have characters. It had to have a plot, suspense. I wanted to make you laugh. And at the end, I wanted to make you cry. It needed resolution, a good ending. So it was, when I sit down at my desk, it's all about craft. I'm working on the story, making a good story. And the great difference, of course, with the narrative nonfiction is that instead of inventing these things out of whole cloth, which is in some ways easier to just make up whatever and whomever you need to serve your theme, I had to choose from the landscape of events that had actually happened and choose from them the very small proportion of things that had happened that would serve the story, that would move the story forward. So, of course, I left out many things that happen in our daily family life that didn't have to do with this particular story of local food. But in the case of nonfiction, it's largely about discipline. You leave out everything that doesn't move your story one step along the way. Yes, right on front.
What happened with you and your family when the year was up?
That's a good question. What happened when the year was up? You know what? We didn't notice. We didn't mark the day. We got to the end of April, and I said, you know what? It's been a year. We began this journey, I suppose, expecting deprivation in some way, but it quickly turned into an exercise in gratitude. We so enjoyed each new month. We learned to begin dinner with the ingredients on hand instead of a recipe and a treasure hunt. We learned to really know where we lived and taste it. And by the end, it was no longer an experiment. It was our life, and we're always going to live this way. We sometimes splurge. We'll occasionally get wild-caught Alaskan salmon or something else that we know was humanely raised. I mean, there's certain things we just won't eat and don't ever. But some things that come from far away, occasionally we will buy as a splurge. We think of them as a splurge instead of thinking of them as something that should be flown to me from another hemisphere every day of the year. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The psychic divide, as you said it.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to whether you've been able to...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.